Foundation loves to support. The Leakey Foundation is terribly important in getting scientists, anthropologists, people interested in human origins, off the ground. I think it's about half of our funding doesn't go to terribly famous, well-established scientists. It's the very first some funding that we give to PhD students, and sometimes pre-PhD students, when they're just starting out, wondering whether they're going to be interested in human origins. A few thousand dollars here, a few thousand dollars there. It's amazing how little a PhD student can survive on. Interested and going. And Mark Hauser first received funding as a PhD student, but he first received funding from the Leakey Foundation as a postdoc. And since then, he has gone on to greater and greater things. Mark Hauser is now at the University of Harvard, Harvard University, I think it's meant to be called. He's with the Department of Anthropology at Harvard University. Mark has written three books, of which the last one he's going to be talking about tonight. His first one was on the evolution of communication, and the title says it all. The origins of communication, starting with animals and moving on into humans. Now, his second book was Wild Minds, which I think the governor of New York must have had a look at before decided to behave in the way that he did. And then his final book, his third book, I think it was last year that it came out. This is what Mark is going to be talking about tonight. Moral Minds is what he called it, and that's obviously what the governor should have looked at. Mark has it.
I've profited many times from funding from the Leakey Foundation, and one of the things that's the most important about the foundation is that we're hitting a time now in the sciences when funding for non-biomedical research is getting harder and harder. I mean, many of us are feeling the sort of pains of that, and the Leakey Foundation continues to be a real source of inspiration and funding. By means of its seeding research that really is not in sort of the traditional areas that foundations like the NSF and NIH fund, so I've been very appreciative of that resource for many, many years now. I want to talk about something that we started looking into about 3 years ago now. And it's a topic which I find sort of deeply fascinating because it's probably one of the more interesting aspects of our biology and our culture, which is our moral psychology. And I want to start off tonight by getting you engaged in a problem by telling you a story. And the story is going to start out in kind of a particular way, and there'll then be two different endings in the story. So in this story, there are two key players. There's an uncle, and there's the uncle's nephew. Now in this family, the nephew stands first in line to inherit the family's great wealth. And the uncle doesn't like this. So one day, the uncle's at home babysitting his nephew, who happens to be upstairs taking a bath, and the uncle decides that if the nephew were not on the planet anymore, he'd be a richer person for it. So he decides that he's going to go upstairs while the nephew is taking a bath, and he's going to drown. And he does, and there is no more. Now, this is a bad uncle, he's got bad intentions, and the consequences are bad. Okay, that's the first part of the story. Now, let's just imagine a slightly different version of the same story. The uncle doesn't like the fact that the nephew is going to inherit the family's wealth. He goes upstairs to drown the nephew, but when he walks in, the nephew is flipped upside down and is now drowning in the bathtub, and the uncle simply walks away, allows the nephew to drown. Now, here, the intentions of the uncle are exactly the same. He intends to kill the nephew. The consequences are exactly the same. The nephew drowns. The only difference is that this is an action, and this is the omission of an action. It's an omission of an action in a case where he perfectly well had the ability to save the nephew with no cost. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at many biomedical cases, and in particular, euthanasia, you see a distinction which looks very much like this one. And that is, active euthanasia in this country and most countries, giving someone an overdose, who is in pain and suffering from a disease in which there is no cure that one knows about, that's illegal. But allowing someone to die, removing life support, or omitting the help is permissible. What's the intuition there? Why should we block active euthanasia but support as morally permissible and legally permissible passive euthanasia? Why should the action be blocked but the omission be supported? When presumably doctors' intentions are the same and certainly the consequences. Person dies in both cases. So what I want to do with you tonight is I want to engage in this kind of question. What is the basis for our moral distinctions? Where do they come from? And how do we judge right from wrong? Okay. Now it's 8 o'clock. Some of you, me included, had a little bit too much wine for dinner. And you may fall asleep. So if you do, just pay attention for 2 minutes and you'll get the conclusions. I'm going to argue tonight, so if you fall asleep, you just have to believe me, that we have evolved, we are endowed with what I'll call a moral faculty, a moral capacity, that has a job. The job is that it evolved to generate intuitive judgments of right and wrong. Now, crucially for tonight, and everything that will follow, I'm going to be telling you about what science has discovered in terms of people's judgments. And I want to distinguish that from what people actually do in a moral context. And here's why that's important. About a year ago, this man, Wesley Autry, was standing on a platform in the subway stations in New York City with his two daughters. He sees a man fall onto the subway tracks unconscious. He looks down the tracks, and here comes the subway. Very quickly, he leaps off the platform, onto the tracks, reorients the man, is on top of him, subway goes over both their heads, both men unscathed. Both men survive. Okay, quick question here. How many of you, raise your hands, would have jumped onto the tracks like was the other track? Raise your hands. Okay, two over there, I think one over here. Okay, so you're all kind of pathetic on the altruistic scale. Let me ask you another question. How many of you think it's morally permissible to jump off the track? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you think it's morally obligatory to jump off the track? Hey, you guys over there that are going to jump, you better raise your hands. Right. Now, what you can quickly see here is our judgments about permissibility and obligatoriness give us some uniformity. But there's going to be lots of things that will enter into what we actually do. They're going to be very, very complicated. And tonight, what I want to hold off is the science of what we do in a moral situation are really not yet achievable. It's very hard to understand what's going on in the doing part. But where we are making progress is the principles that underlie the judgment. So tonight, what I'm going to argue is that the principles that we've begun to uncover that underlie these judgments of rights and wrongs look like, to a large extent, they're inaccessible to your conscious awareness. Not only are you not aware of them, you couldn't be aware of them unless you study the phenomenon. This is not a claim about your intelligence. This is a claim about the science. It's a claim about your brain. Your brain is captive in terms of these principles. It's holding on to them, and you can't get access to them, but they drive your judgments. And they do so in a way that makes you immune to any kind of cultural background. So the brain's machinery is an immune system in one sense, and it blocks off any effects of cultural background. And tonight I'll show you that. I'll show you some evidence for universality. And the third point I'll make is that those principles or rules are completely cold. Most people think that we engage in moral judgments, we're recruiting our emotions. What I'm going to argue tonight, based in part on some work from the neurosciences, the science of the brain, is that the computation, the calculation that enters into our moral judgments is cold. It does not recruit our emotions. Where emotions play a role is in guiding our behavior. It guided Wesley Autry onto the tracks. The third point I'll make tonight is what I really want to conclude with, is that the more we understand about the biology of these judgments, the better we'll be in terms of understanding what kinds of legal policies will be effective, what kinds of educational policies will be effective, because we'll understand the kind of psychological and neural mechanisms that bias us in one direction as opposed to another. Okay, so now you can fall asleep. But if you don't fall asleep, here's what I'll treat you to. The first thing I want to do tonight is I want to place the ideas that we've been working on in my lab for now several years in a historical context. I want to tell you about the ways we've thought about the moral faculty by telling you a little bit about the history of research into thinking about the nature of our moral judgments. Having given you the theory behind these ideas, I'll then give you some empirical evidence that we've been working on for many years now about what we want to call a universal moral grammar, a set of principles that are very abstract and unconscious and inaccessible, but that nonetheless guide your moral judgments. And then lastly, I'll tell you about how the sciences of the brain have begun to uncover some very interesting things about the nature of the mechanisms that underpin what I'll call the universal moral grammar. Okay, so let me first tell you a little about the history. There have traditionally been two thoughts about the sources of our moral judgments. The first really dates back to David Hume, the philosopher and the British empiricist. David Hume argued that when we deliver a moral judgment that we should help someone or that it's permissible to harm someone, it's an intuitive process, it's unconscious, you're not really aware of it, but crucially, the source of that intuition are the emotional systems. We feel a certain way, those feelings drive our moral judgments to help somebody or to hurt somebody. So crucially, it's intuitive, it's unconscious, and the emotions are doing all the work. Now those ideas lay dormant for many, many years, but were picked up empirically by two psychologists in the 1970s and 80s, Martin Hoffman, who focused on empathy. The child's development of empathy is a crucial emotion in the moral domain. Feeling what it's like to feel like someone else, being in someone else's shoes, those are emotional experiences that change over development, but form a core aspect of our helping of others. And more recently, the psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who argued that even though we tend to think of ourselves as rationally working through moral problems, coming up with explicit reasons for why something is right or wrong, in fact, that's an illusion. The rational part is preceded by a flash of intuition, and that flash of intuition is driven by our emotions. So that's one view, the Humean view, anchored in our emotions. The second view, kind of the book and opposite, is one that goes back at least to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, but many other people as well, who argue that our moral judgments are first and foremost a rational process. We think about the issue, we think about the principles, the rules, the regulations, the arguments, and we justify why we think something is right or wrong based on those principles. It's conscious, it's rational, and it's justifiable. Now, like the Humean view, the Kantian views and philosophy really remain outside the domain of any kind of empirical work until the developmental psychologist Larry Kohlberg hit the scene and started to think about the development of the child's moral system. Kohlberg, in brief, thought about stages of moral development that we all go through. Early in development, we pay attention only to the consequences. If I hit someone, that's bad, but if I trip and hit someone, that's equally bad, because the harm was done. So early in development, children are not paying attention to the means by which consequences take place. They only pay attention to the consequences. So for Kohlberg, the Kantian principles of what's right or wrong really fueled how you allocate kids into different stages of moral development. And the crucial test, done amazingly in 45 minutes, was how you justify your actions, how you decide why something is permissible and something else is forbidden. So it's through language and it's through behavior. You look at the actions, you look at the justifications, and you put someone at a moral stage of development. And more recently, the philosopher Chris Korsgaard has taken that view further. So here we have these two bookend opposites for the source of our judgments. And what I want to argue tonight is that they're both problematic, but in different ways. First of all, it's clearly problematic from the Kantian view that we have these flashes of intuition that don't seem to be reasoned at all. The problem for the Jungian view is, what tells the emotional system that you should feel empathetic? How did the emotional system get that intuition to begin with? What told the system that it was in a moral situation as opposed to any other social situation? So something's amiss for both of these views. The position that I want to argue tonight is a view which is owed to the late political philosopher John Rawls, who borrowed heavily from the thinking of the linguist Noam Chomsky. And here was the idea. Rawls argued that when we're confronted with a particular moral problem, we spontaneously deliver a judgment. In the same way that when we're confronted with a beautiful painting, we deliver a judgment of its beauty. Or the same way that when we are confronted with a joke, we either laugh or we don't. It's hard to understand why we had that kind of response. In part, as Rawls argued, because the principles are simply not accessible. What Rawls argued in the 70s was that the same way that we deliver a rapid judgment of grammaticality for a sentence, whether it's well-formed or not, we deliver an ethicality judgment for the moral domain. We are confronted with a problem, and spontaneously, we deliver the ethicality judgment, right or wrong. What I'll argue tonight is that these are based on rules of action that appeal to what is the causes and intention of an agent, what they did, and the consequences that ensue, but we have no access to what those principles are. All right, that's very abstract. Let me try now to work through those three kinds of examples or theories by giving you toy models for how to think about how the process might work. There are many other permutations, but I'm going to give you three just to think about the problem. Let's imagine what the Jungian view would look like. Well, it would look something like this. Imagine you're walking down the street and you see a man with a dagger in his hand and a dead body next to him. That perceptual event on the Jungian view triggers an emotion. That emotion triggers a moral judgment. That is wrong, whatever happened there. So the entire process links to the emotions. Crucially, the emotions are causally prior to the moral judgment and they're necessary. Here's a bit of a blended view. It's a view which unites the Humean emotional perspective with the conscious reasoning view of a Kantian perspective. You perceive that event, but some aspect of the perception triggers an emotion, but some aspect triggers also conscious reasoning. Now, depending on the situation, these two may agree or they may disagree. Something in the brain must adjudicate between those to give you a coherent moral judgment. But again, importantly, emotions and conscious reasoning are happening before moral judgment. The Rawlsian view is different, not because it doesn't invite emotion and conscious reasoning, but because emotion and conscious reasoning happen after moral judgment. On this view, the perceptual event in and of itself is what's doing all the work. It's breaking down the situation to why did that agent do what he or she did? What were their beliefs? What were their goals? What were their intentions? And what were the consequences? And based on that analysis alone, unconscious, you get a moral judgment. That moral judgment may trigger an emotion, and it certainly may trigger conscious reasoning and reflection. Now here's the surprising thing. If you go back in time about a few years ago, there were no empirical data, no science, to distinguish between these hypotheses. Everybody agrees that emotion's involved. But the question here is, where is emotion involved? Now, here's where the neurosciences become extremely important to the debate. If I ask you, well, do you feel a certain way when you decide what's right or wrong? You'll say, of course I do. That's irrelevant. That's introspection. I don't care that you feel emotional. I care when you feel emotional and when it plays a role in your judgment. The neurosciences are beginning to have an increasing understanding of how the brain triggers emotional experiences. Let's now fast forward to 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. Now let's say we have an exquisite understanding of the mechanisms of the brain that give us our emotional experiences. And let's say we had patients who had damage to those emotional experiences, those emotional areas. Or let's say we had a technique that would allow you to turn off our emotions, then turn back on again. What would happen here? Well, on the emotional view that Hume delivers, if your emotions are turned off, that should give you very different moral judgments, because you need the emotions first to generate the moral judgment. On this view down here, insofar as a moral problem recruits our emotions, then if those emotional areas are knocked out, that should also give a very deviant moral judgment relative to someone who has a healthy emotional system. There may, however, be certain kinds of moral problems that don't recruit our emotions. They're simple calculations. For example, if I have the option of saving one person or five, everything else equal, I go for five. All else equal. No emotion, simple mathematics. So there, everything's fine. But look what happens on this view. If the emotional systems are damaged, it's irrelevant. Because the knowledge that feeds into the moral judgment is all you need. Here, emotions have a role to play, perhaps in our behavior, not in our moral judgments. Let's make it concrete. Let's think for the moment about a clinical disorder, psychopathy. Psychopaths are clinically diagnosed as people who have severe emotional deficits. They don't feel guilt, they don't feel remorse, they don't feel shame, they don't feel empathy. Their emotional systems are functionally shut down. The classic diagnosis of psychopathy is that because they don't have those emotions, they do the wrong thing. They don't know right from wrong because there's no emotional inspiration to guide them. But here's an alternative. They know perfectly well what's right or wrong, they just don't care. Now that matters, not just because the science is interesting, it matters for legal policy. The law is constantly trying to evaluate, did the person do something knowingly? On this view, they did it knowingly, they just don't care. Emotion on this view is a break or a facilitator for moral behavior. It's not what gives us our moral knowledge. So part of the story tonight is that maybe for the first time, the sciences are beginning to make an impact on age-old questions in philosophy in a serious way. What are the sources of our moral judgments and how can we know? Okay, so that's a quick sketch of the background. And what I want to now do is take you into some of the data that have basically begun to emerge that really begin to tell between these different possibilities and add on much more to our understanding of the moral domain. About 3 years ago, when we got interested in this problem, my students and I developed a website based on the idea that if we really wanted to understand what people at large, did when confronted with moral problems, we would need a large data set. And web-based technology are now becoming a real engine for much work in the social sciences. So we put up this website called the Moral Sense Test. When you leave, you can go play. People log on to the website. They find it for a variety of reasons. And when they log on, they give information about who they are, their age, their education, religious background, and so forth. And then they proceed to encounter a variety of moral dilemmas, and they give us their answers. After a period of about 3 years, we now have about 250,000 subjects from 120 countries. In the first round, of course, they're all English speakers because the text was written in English. If you log on today, you will see a Dutch version, a Chinese version, and a Spanish version. The age ranges we have are typically between 13 and 70. That doesn't mean that 80-year-olds aren't on the site. It doesn't mean that 6-year-olds aren't on the site. They are. But the concentrations between these age ranges. We have kids who are in the elementary grades. We have people with PhDs, MDs, and JDs. And we have a variety of people with various religious backgrounds. Okay. Now, the first thing I need to do tonight is justify why we use what I'll call artificial moral alumnus, as opposed to real-world cases. It's important I do this because this is what drives much of the science I'll tell you about tonight. So I'm going to give you three reasons why artificial cases are useful. The first thing is that if you look at the history of many sciences, in particular the cognitive sciences, the neurosciences, when scientists confront big problems, they can't ask, how does morality work? That's a crazy question. In fact, it's not a question. What you have to do is break down these very complicated phenomena into pieces. We can't ask, how did language evolve? We can't ask how morality evolved, but we can ask about the components of language or morality. We can ask, how did symbolic systems evolve? How did grammatical structures evolve? We can ask, how did the concepts of right and wrong evolve? How did the emotions that subserve morality evolve? How did cooperation evolve? Those are more answerable questions. So you take a complex question and you break it down into manageable pieces. So in the area of language, Chomsky's famous sentence, colorless green ideas sleep furiously, is a grammatically well-formed sentence, but it doesn't mean anything. And that simply showed with an artificial case that at some level, syntax and semantics are separate systems. Similarly, in the visual sciences, you present people with illusions to show how the visual system kind of breaks down, or how it works, and how illusions are illusions, because it doesn't matter what we believe. We know it's false. We know when we see an Escher drawing that it can't be, but our visual system isn't listening. It's an illusion. I want to give you an example of an illusion tonight, or one example, by playing you a sound. I'm going to play you a sound, and what I want you just to do is to listen to it, and then raise your hand if you have an interpretation of what the sound is. If you've heard this case before, please don't answer. Okay, anybody have an interpretation of that? Yeah. Computer. Good.
Yeah?
R2-D2
from Star Wars.
R2-D2 from Star Wars. Okay. Anybody else?
Whales.
Whales. Okay. Yeah.
Like the experimental music experiments at Stanford.
Experimental music? Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Playing with sound? Yep.
Something
played backwards. Okay. Now I'm going to play just a different version of that same sound.
The steady drip is worse than a drenching rain.
Now I'm going to play the first verse again to show you I'm not cheating.
The steady drip is worse than a drenching rain.
That is what is called sine wave speech. If you look at the structure of speech, an incredibly complicated acoustic waveform with many things going on at the same time, time-varying information, frequency-varying information, amplitude-varying information, phase relationships. It's hard to study speech like that, but you can study speech by breaking it down to relevant components. And what sine wave speech is that you take a sine wave and you run it over what are called the formant frequencies of the voice, or the resonance frequencies. It's the vibrations that are caused due to the filtering properties of the vocal tract. That's the information-bearing content of speech. So you can show what's crucial to speech perception by running experiments like this. So again, take-home message, complicated problem, break it down to something simple and artificial, you begin to make some traction.
The steady drip is worse than a drench. Okay.
Second point. For the moral domain, the real-world cases, abortion, euthanasia, organ donations, you have rehearsed them so many times, there is no more intuition. You know what's right or wrong. Now, we can have an argument about it. I may be able to shift you. You may be able to shift me. But you've got already explicit principles for why you think it's right or wrong. Now, this can become dangerous, of course, because often the arguments you make are based on an analogy. I was talking with some people this evening about stem cell research. If you walk down the street and ask people, stem cell research, right or wrong? Take the people who say wrong, and now ask them, what's a stem cell? you'll often get blank stares. Why is it wrong? Oh, it's wrong because it's killing a baby. Is a stem cell a baby? I don't think so. But they've mapped on baby bad, stem cell bad. So they've generalized. This is, of course, what's dangerous. So the point here is that taking the real-world cases, unfortunately, don't give us any traction because it's so well rehearsed. So we have to move away from the real-world cases but capture some of the crucial distinctions. Now, interestingly, sometimes the real-world cases feed back into the artificial cases. The artificial cases are powerful scientifically the way that a model is powerful scientifically. You can create a space in which you can begin to manipulate pieces of the problem, see how they affect other pieces. So take the moral domain, think of it as a space, think of the variables, and now begin to manipulate those. A year ago, in South Africa, a woman went to visit some caves. She went up to the ticket booth and asked the man, can I have a ticket to get in the cave? He said, ma'am, I'm sorry, but you're too heavy to get into the tunnels. We can't let you go through. She pleaded, she begged, and eventually she was let in. Sadly, she got stuck in the tunnel entrance, the only entrance to the tunnels, an exit, and she trapped 22 people behind her. Now, for those of you who read philosophy, you'll recognize this as a famous dilemma. If a woman gets stuck in a cave, trapping people behind her, is it okay to blow her up? Now, it's funny, but it happened. Fortunately, after 10 hours, they were able to use paraffin and squeak her out. But it's a real-world case in the following sense. A, it happened, but B, it puts into opposition the value of one life versus the value of many lives. Under what circumstances is it okay to take a life to save many more? This is a classic problem in philosophy, but it's not simply a made-up example. This happens. So what philosophers have done is they've created artificial cases which capture some of the crucial psychology that appears to enter into some of our more important biomedical and real-world ethical cases like euthanasia, like abortion, and so forth. But the philosophers stay in one zone. They say, well, my intuition is that this is the reason why abortion is okay. This is the reason why euthanasia is okay. My question as a biologist is the intuition that the philosopher brings forward that individual's intuition or the species' intuition? Whose intuitions? Are philosophers' intuitions tutored up, or do they share something with our folks? Let me now give you one of the classic problems in philosophy. Some of you will have heard these. I'm going to give you this example that will run throughout tonight to show you how you can permute things. But I want to flag up front, this is just one example of hundreds of dilemmas we've created, some of them more apocryphal, some of them more close to the real world. Here's how this problem begins. A trolley is moving down a track, and the conductor notices five hikers up ahead of the track ahead. He slams on the brakes, but the brakes fail. The conductor passes out unconscious. If the trolley continues, it will kill five people. Okay. First dilemma. A bystander, maybe you, is standing next to a switch. There is a sidetrack. There's one person on that sidetrack. If the bystander flips the switch, trolley goes on to the sidetrack, killing the one, but saving the five. If the bystander does nothing, omits the switching action, trolley continues and kills the five. If you think it's permissible for the bystander to flip the switch, raise your hand. You have to vote. Okay, it's permissible. If you think it's not permissible, raise your hand. Okay, a couple people here and here. All right, good. When we asked this question on the internet to several thousands of people, here's what we got. 89% said yes, basically what we got right here in the audience. Okay, that's permissible. Now, a little change in the dilemma. Here's the five. Whoops. The bystander can throw this big guy off the bridge. He goes down, he stops the trolley, the five are saved. Okay? And I would have asked you the question, but you probably already saw the answer. Only 11% say yes. Now notice, If you adhere to a very powerful view in philosophy known as utilitarianism, where consequences matter, you better be in this 11% if you answered yes to the previous question, because the consequence is the same. This action leads to the saving of 5, just like switching the track leads to saving of 5. But as you can see, most people flip-flop. Most people say yes to the first case and no here. But this is bad science, because there are too many things going on that are different between these cases. Here you have to touch somebody, in a case you only hit the switch. Here you introduce a threat to this guy, in the previous case you redirect an ongoing threat. Here's a big guy, last one's a skinny guy. So too many things are variable. If the science is going to progress, we have to narrow the differences to zoom in on a single difference. So here's the tripod. Here's the 5, here's the bystander, here's the big guy. Here's a little loop. If you flip the switch, trolley goes on, kills him, he's dead, trolley stops before it gets to the 5. Now notice that if he is not on the track, flipping the switch is irrelevant. Because it just goes on to the loop, back on, kills the 5. You need him as the means to the greater good. Without him, no solution. When you ask this question, is it permissible to flip the switch? 52% say yes. Now notice, this is a whopping difference with the previous case, where you throw him off the bridge. And yet, you throw him off the bridge as a means, you flip the switch, and you use him as a means. So the simple difference between switch versus push, massive difference in permissibility. All right. But now let's take this case and compare it with a very close relative. Man, bystander, 5. Same players. He, unfortunately, is not heavy. If you flip the switch, he by himself wouldn't do anything, but what stops the trolley is the weight in front. Now notice what happens. If he's not on the track, not only is it permissible to flip the switch, it's obligatory, because no harm is done. So here, killing him is merely a foreseen side effect, because your goal is to hit the weight. And when you ask this question, 76% say yes. All right, let's bring those two cases back. How many of you were raised Catholic? Raise your hand, don't be shy. What's this distinction? Come on, you're all raised Catholic. What's the story? No one?
Principle of double effect.
Excellent, principle of effect. Who said it?
Thomas Aquinas.
So all the other Catholics, gotta go study up. Thomas Aquinas said that it is permissible to engage in a harmful behavior for a greater good insofar as the harm is not the means to a greater good. This distinguishes these cases. When we ask people who said this case is more permissible than this case, virtually no one gave us the explanation. It seems to be driving the judgment, but seems to be not accessible to conscious awareness. All right, that's simply one point case. So here's what we did. We came up with a wide variety of moral dilemmas that tested 3 kinds of principal distinctions. The first is the one I just spoke about, the doctrine of double effect, or what we'll call the intention principle. The principle is simple. Harm intended as the means to a goal is going to be perceived as morally worse than an equivalent harm foreseen as the side effect of a goal. So means versus side effects. That's principle one. Principle two is what we started with, the action principle. Harms caused by action are perceived as morally worse than cases of omission, holding the consequences the same. And three, we just touched upon, harm caused by physically contacting someone will be perceived as worse than a non-contact case like flipping a switch. You give a whole suite of moral dilemmas, and consistently, these principles shine through. People consistently, thousands and thousands of people, see harm by means as worse than a foreseen side effect, actions as worse than omissions, and contact as worse than non-contact. But are they aware of these distinctions? You say, hey, you thought this case is worse than that. Why? Are they aware of it? When you ask about the cases that involve the attention principle, people have no clue. They say, I don't know. It's a hunch, gut feeling, but I don't know. So here's a case where the principle in itself is not available to conscious awareness for most people, but it drives their moral beliefs. In the case of the action principle, people are aware. They'll say actions are worse than omitting the action. The contact principle is the most interesting, I find, because about half of our subjects say, well, if you hit somebody, that's worse than if you just flip the switch. And they go, well, wait a minute. That shouldn't have any moral relevance. So what it looks like is happening here is they're reconstructing based on what they perceived, but then they deny its moral relevance. So what we're beginning to uncover is a set of distinctions that seem to drive people's moral judgments. Some seem to do so completely outside of the realm of conscious awareness, and some seem to be in our conscious awareness, and we seem to be accessing them when we make our judgments. Now, what I just finished telling you from Aquinas is that means-based harms are bad. Right? That's where you block off. Is that always the case? Here's a trolley. Here's one. Here's five. If the trolley continues, it first kills one, and then it kills five. Is it okay for the bystander to throw a rock beaming the one who screams, alerting the five, you get off track of time, the one dies? Absolutely. How about this one? Can the bystander throw a dead guy into a track and stop the trolley and save the five? Absolutely. What about throwing a guy who's about to die? Is that a sign that just says, I've led a great life. Do not resuscitate. 78%. I find this very warm and comforting. That there's a difference between a guy who's about to die and a guy who's dead. Like, you know, give him his last moments, right? So in some sense, you're making him a little bit worse off. But what's going on here is something quite profound. And it's what economists have talked about for a long time. It's what's called a Pareto optimal case. And that is, it is permissible to use someone as a means to a greater good insofar as you don't make them worse off. You don't make the one worse off. You don't make that guy worse off. You make him a little worse off. And here, means-based harms are permissible. What you should now be getting is a rich complexity of cases which are building up to give us the nature of our moral judgments. All right. Now, a deep question about the analogy to language is cultural variation. Many of you will be thinking, but look, this is ridiculous about universality. Look at all the variation in what people think of as permissible. All the atrocities in the world. These cultures abuse animals, these cultures don't abuse animals. These cultures have honor killings, these cultures don't have honor killings. Come on, there's no universality. Now remember, I'm talking about judgment as opposed to behavior. But let's ask the question, to what extent are the distinctions we've just been talking about variable across culture? So I want to do that in two ways. The first question is, given the strength of the arguments for religion providing people with their moralities, to what extent does religion impact on the kinds of moral dilemmas we've been talking about? Does your religious background matter? Second question. Everything I've told you has come from this internet sample. Okay, it's huge, 250,000 people, but it's people who get onto the internet. That's maybe a very narrow part of the population. What about other societies? Do small-scale, hunter-gatherer type societies deliver similar kinds of moral judgments? Tonight only I have a chance to tell you about a little bit of this work, but we've been collaborating with anthropologists, many of them funded by the Leakey Foundation, working in a variety of parts of the world with hunter-gatherer populations. Very, very different from our internet sample. Okay, let's first start with religious background. What role does religion have in making moral judgments? We're going to we're going to contrast tonight atheists, people who log on and say, I am an atheist, versus anyone else who claims to have any kind of religious background, whether weak or strong, in terms of their faith, which we ask. If you look at those four trolley problems that I just told you about, religious background plays no role. Whether you are extreme religious, whether you're any kind of denomination, versus an atheist, you get exactly the same patterns of judgments. Religious people, people with a religious faith, think the fat man case is impermissible, and they also think that the bystander switch case is more permissible. And that's true for atheists as well. So on the harming level, no difference we can see for any of the cases we looked at. Well, maybe you think, well, look, we know that people who come from religious faith often give a lot to charity. The data are ambiguous here. Much of the donations to charity are to their own religious denomination. What about outside of that? What about cases of helping? When you look at a variety of cases of moral dilemmas involving helping others, no difference either. For example, you're driving by the country road one day in a brand new sports car, beautiful white leather interior, and there's a man by the side of the road with a bloody leg, flags you down. So can you please take me to the hospital? My leg is bleeding. You go, oof, man, a couple $100 to fix my leather interior. Should I drive on or not? Well, no one says drive on. That's equally true, people are religious or not. And that runs across a whole variety of helping cases. So in terms of the dilemmas we've been able to look at, we find no difference of religious background on the nature of moral judgments. Let's push harder on that with a much tougher case. What about the possibility that all that religion does for people, in addition to what people get out of it in terms of spirituality, what it does in terms of the moral world is it gives you restricted rules. It tells you how to behave in very local cases. Abortion. Judy Thompson, in the 1970s, when many of the debates about the legality of abortion were being debated, raised the following question. She wanted to understand to what extent does the fetus, whenever you say life begins, when does the fetus, if at all, have an obligatory right to the woman's body? An obligatory right to the woman's body. That was the question. Now, what Thompson, of course, acknowledged, and which we can show in spades with any kind of data you want, is that if you ask traditional cases of abortion, when abortion is right or wrong, and you ask people who are religious or atheists, you get exactly what you expect. People who are religious tend to be more pro-life, and people who are atheists tend to be more pro-choice. Not surprising. What Thompson did was the classic philosophical move. Take people away from what they're familiar with and give them a case which bears on some of the crucial issues that are involved in abortion. So here is Thompson's apocryphal case. One morning, this guy wakes up in bed to find this woman lying next to him. A little shocked. This guy walks up and says, look, I'm terribly sorry, but this woman lying next to you is the world's most famous violinist. She's in kidney failure. We've plugged her into your kidney. If you stay plugged in for the next 9 months, she will survive and you will have saved her life. If you don't plug, she dies. She needs you, specifically you. In the scenario, he goes, you know, I kind of like her music. I'll stay plugged in. And he does. They're talking, they're enjoying the music, they're talking about the world. But after 2 months, he goes, you know what, this is really a drag. He unplugs. Now you ask people, was that permissible? You must scale permissibility. What do you find? No difference between people who are religious Arabians. Now, this is not a case of abortion, but it carries some of the crucial pieces of the distinction that comes in when people think about abortion. She needs him. He has made a commitment to her. He's along the way to making that commitment. It would be very nice of him to oblige what she needs, but he's not obliged. So the point simply here is that when you begin to fade away from what's familiar, the abortion case, and you capture the psychology that's involved in abortion, what you see is a common code running through, where religion has no impact whatsoever. So take home point one, strip away the familiarity, give cases people are not familiar with, and you see a common code running through independently. Okay, what about variation that's not what we see on the internet? So although we've begun doing work with people like Frank Marlowe, working with the Hadza in Tanzania, and other populations, working with hunter-gatherers, these are the data sets that we have that really now begin to tell an interesting story about possible variation. So together with a grad student at Harvard named Linda Arbanel, who's been working for now 4 years with a very remote population of Mayans in the Chiapas region of Mexico, we started the process of basically giving people moral dilemmas and getting their judgments. This is hard work. It's hard work because, of course, you can't tell them about trolleys. You've got to do something else. But more importantly, you have to translate into their language, back translate into English to make sure it's the same story, and then go back again into the foreign language. That takes a lot of time. So the first thing we did was we gave this Mayan population of adults with no education, no explicit religion except for their own, cases that involve the means to side effect distinction. And they basically had to enter on the scale from one being bad to five being good. And when we do that, we find exactly the effect we find with our instrument sample. That is, side effect cases are more permissible, they're more on the good side than our means-based harm. That's nice for two reasons. It shows that our translations are working, that our scales are working, the technique works, and we are recovering what the internet sample showed. This looks like a mean side effect is going through, even in a very different kind of culture. So then we turn to the action omission distinction. And what do we find? No difference. Now this was a shock to me, because the action omission distinction is very robust in our samples. So why didn't it show up here? I thought, well, maybe the dilemmas we were using were weird in some sense. Let's try it again. Try it again. No difference again. No significant difference between actions and harm and omissions and harm. So we thought, look, we just run a set of moral dilemmas with young kids in Cambridge who were between 3 and 5 years old. And they show the action-omission distinction. They see actions as worse than omissions. So let's take the kid examples. Happens, no difference again. Now this is fascinating. It goes completely against what I expected. I expected exactly the same patterns, that actions would be perceived as more bad as omissions. Why? Well, this begins to invoke the analogy to language. Could it be that we are born with a bias to see actions as worse than omissions, as evidenced by our American population? If we test Mayan kids, they'll see actions as worse than omissions, but something about the culture changes that, gets rid of that. And there are these two possibilities, not mutually exclusive. One is the Mayans have something like the Good Samaritan law that we see in places like France. The omission of help is as bad as the harm. That's one possibility. The second possibility, related to that, is that it's not about being a Mayan, it's about living in a small-scale society. That when you know everyone, omissions are bad, they're noticeable, in the way that in a large-scale society, they simply aren't. So what we're trying to do is unpack the distinction between large-scale and small-scale. It's very hard to do because in this country, although there are really small-scale societies, it's often confounded with education. So the crucial thing is to try to figure out why do you get a situation where even young kids, in the United States at least, show the distinction, but then it seems to be lost in certain kinds of cultures. So what we come up with is really what I think of as an abstract grammar of action. That for any given case, you can come up with an explanation. You can say, well, of course I flip the switch because I'm trying to save the greater good. But of course that fails when you go to the pushing of the man. As you pile up more and more of these dilemmas, you begin to lose an explanation for what's right or wrong. And that's because, just like language, which involves many complexities in terms of the computation, so too does morality. It invites, what's the goal? What's the intention? What's the belief? What are the means? What kind of harm? what kind of contact, what kind of overall good. That's complicated. That's what's underlying our moral judgments. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to end with how the neuroscience has begun to give us even more insight into this complicated computation. Over the past few years, in collaboration with many, many scientists, we've been involved in studies using functional magnetic resonance imaging, looking at the imaging of healthy brains, studies using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes, studies of autistic populations, where a very powerful aspect and devastating aspect of the deficit is a loss of an ability to impute beliefs, intentions, and goals to others, that presumably has very dramatic effects on their moral judgments. Studies of psychopaths, which I'll come back to, which we mentioned, have severe emotional deficits. And studies looking at brain damaged patients who have very focal damage to certain parts of the brain, which seem to lead to very specific deficits in some aspects of their cognitive abilities, leaving others perfectly well intact. Tonight, what I want to tell you about are two sets of studies. One, a very new study that we just completed really about a week ago, and another study using this technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation that is basically now well underway. Now remember this figure, right back to the beginning. We said we have three sort of toy models for the role of emotion in our moral judgment. The Jungian view argues that if you don't have emotions, or if they're really, really off in some way, you will give completely bankrupt moral judgments. It will be very, very different from anybody else. On this view, only moral dilemmas that really recruit the emotions will show differences, but for some that are kind of cool calculations of utilitarian consequences, it'll be okay. But on this view, the emotions are irrelevant, and your moral knowledge is perfectly well intact, and you will give judgments that are like everyone else. How do you test that? So together with some colleagues of mine working in Holland, who have access to a fairly large population of psychopaths who've been imprisoned, but also have access to delinquents who are in prison, but not psychopaths, a crucial control population, we can begin asking this question. And here's the crucial test. If you're a Humean and you think emotions are necessary for moral judgment, then damage to emotions, as in psychopaths, should lead to a lack of concern for moral rights and wrongs, and thus to doing the wrong thing. So you're going to give weird moral judgments, and you're going to do the wrong thing. On the Rawlsian view, if emotion is necessary, it's only necessary for moral behavior, not for moral judgment. And therefore, the lack of emotions will play no role in moral judgments, only in what you do. So here's what we did. We tested 8 prison-convicted psychopaths who had been convicted of numerous crimes of violence, sometimes violence and theft, had been evaluated by a clinician in terms of their severe emotional deficits, and we compared them with 10 non-psychopathic delinquents, some of which were violent but not psychopaths, some of which would kill people but were not psychopaths. So this is a crucial test. We give them 21 different moral dilemmas. They're moral dilemmas because there is no real right or wrong answer, just like we showed tonight. If you say it's permissible to push the fat guy, it's not that it's wrong, it's that you're, relatively speaking, in a minority. If you said yes, you're in a majority. There's no right or wrong answer. This is crucial because psychopaths are smart. They know what answer people are looking for. Here, there is no right or wrong answer. Questions, what do they do? So you give these 21 moral dilemmas, you compare psychopaths with non-psychopaths, and here's the odd. Not a shred of difference. Not for overall 21 cases, nor for any given dilemma. So even though there's a massive difference in emotional profiles for psychopaths versus non-psychopaths, there is no difference in the nature of their judgments. This looks like strong support the Rawlsian idea that emotions fall out of the moral judgments as opposed to leading the moral judgments. All right, that's one hit. That's where the neuroscience can begin to make some play. Here's another one.
We know that in all aspects of our life, both moral and non-moral, that beliefs ought to interact with the outcomes of what we do. But they also play a crucial role in the moral world. In religion, Protestants have a general view that if you've done something wrong, when you've done something wrong, it's wrong when you've done it, or when you believe you would do something wrong. So sin is belief, and sin is outcome. But in the Judaic tradition, you can have all bad beliefs you want. It matters only what you do. Right? So religions play upon the belief-outcome distinction. That's the first place. The second is in development. I mentioned this at the beginning in terms of Kohlberg's view. Early development, children only pay attention to the outcomes and seem to be blind to the beliefs. They don't take into account what people believe in terms of the evaluation of the outcomes. In neuroimaging experiments, brain activation, where you give people various kinds of problems having to do with beliefs and outcomes, there's one area of the brain, there's many, but there's one area in particular, which seems to be rather selectively activated when beliefs are involved in the story. And that's an area called the temporal parietal junction. If you push in your temporal lobe here, that's basically the region. That area heavily activates when you read stories about people's beliefs. And then lastly, in law, the law distinguishes between crimes of intent, crimes of negligence, failed attempt, and so forth. It traffics between beliefs and outcomes. If I believe and intend to harm someone, but I failed, that was attempted harm. If I didn't believe or intend to harm someone, but I do, it's accidental, and sometimes it's negligent. So here's what we did. We used this technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is basically a way of delivering rapid pulses to part of the cortex, quite locally, that functionally turns off that area of the brain. It deactivates it. And if you do it repeatedly, you can deactivate the area for 10, 12, 15 minutes, and then it comes back. So it's like creating a lesion without creating a lesion. It's basically putting that area of the brain asleep. So here's the question. What if you put the right temporal parietal junction to sleep? That's the area that's involved in beliefs. You take it out, and now you want to ask, how do people judge the moral world when the belief system has been greatly expressed? So what we did was we gave people little vignettes, little stories. They always start out with some kind of foreshadowing, like Grace put some powder in her friend's coffee. In one case, it's unknowing harm. Grace thinks the powder is sugar. Turns out it's toxic. Her friend's dogs. Or attempted harm. Grace thinks the powder is toxic. That turns out it's sugar. Her friend is fine. So people are reading these cases, and they're evaluating the permissibility of the agent's action. Each person is their own control. So you provide TMS, this right temporal parietal junction, the belief area, into an area just behind, which is in the parietal area, which is much more involved in attention, but not this. Okay, so you're going to compare the control stimulation to the parietal area and the zap to the temporal parietal junction. Here's what we find. So the scale here is from forbidden to permissible. The red is the judgment under TMS to the belief area, and this is the control. For attempted harm, here's what happens. When you TMS this area, the region becomes, the example becomes much more permissible. So although you are attempting harm, I don't understand your beliefs anymore. So the outcome, because nothing happened, is much more permissible. In the accidental case, you get the opposite effect. Now it becomes much less permissible, because now you're basing explicitly on the outcomes. So with a simple manipulation of taking out, suppressing the belief area, we functionally turn people into children and Jews. You can have all the bad beliefs you want. In this case, no, no. Only outcomes matter. You're like a child. All right, getting some conclusions then. The studies of psychopaths rule out at least a strong version of the Humean idea that emotions are causally necessary for moral judgments. If that would have been the case, they should have given judgments very, very different from the delinquents. They have very damaged emotional systems, but the pattern of judgments are very much the same. This is important for the law because in things like the Modal Penal Code that try to understand what someone did knowingly, you have psychopaths who know right from wrong, but do the wrong thing. That's relevant to the law, all of which is very relevant to the target of therapy. The second point is the TMS studies pinpoint a core component of what I've been talking about in the moral domain, the moral faculty, and that's the belief system. The belief system is a crucial part of the computation. What did the agent believe? That plays a crucial role in all these dilemmas. As in child development, when you take out this area, people focus on the consequences. They only pay attention to the consequences. This may have important implications for autism, because autism is a disorder which functionally takes out the belief system. And so maybe by understanding the neuroscience of areas like temporal parietal junction and its connectivity, we may have some hope of better understanding autism. Let me end now with some of the broader conclusions and implications, and then leave you with some implications for the law in particular. So what I'm trying to argue tonight is that our brain evolved a system that allows us to intuitively and rapidly generate judgments of right and wrong. Some of the distinctions that drive these judgments are unconscious, and some of them seem to be universally shared. In this sense, there seems to be an immunity to any kind of cultural influences. Obviously, the data on the Mayan show ways in which there can be cultural influences and give us some of the variations we see. The second point I want to make tonight is that although the Humean view is in a very powerful role in philosophy and in current psychology, I think a more powerful explanation of what we see in terms of our moral judgments is the calculation is largely cold. The calculation is based on our belief systems, our systems of intentions and goals that drive our moral judgments in the absence of any emotional activation. Where emotions seem to play their strongest role is in guiding our behavior, either facilitating altruistic actions or facilitating aggressive and possibly violent actions. The third point is that although we're still really at the most primitive stages of this kind of work, we really don't understand an awful lot of what's going on. And so the analogy to language is something up for grabs. The analogy to language opens up a class of questions that really haven't been asked before. And as a scientist, that to me is the most exciting. Perhaps more importantly, maybe this kind of work will have some implications for legal and educational policies. We always have to be careful, as biologists thinking about human nature, that we don't cross over a descriptive account into a prescriptive account of what we ought to do. Everything I've told you tonight is a description of what people do. It is not a prescription for what we ought to do. But it has important implications. Let me give you three. There are countries, as I mentioned, like France and Quebec, that have a Good Samaritan law. The law simply states that if you perceive someone in danger, it is your obligation to help them. Omitting the help is wrong. It's as wrong as hurting them. So it's the wrongness of omission. Now, a crucial question here becomes, how hard is it for the French, the Quebecois, to really digest this law? Given the fact the action omission distinction is so powerful. Maybe it's like the Mayans. Maybe once you get that thing on board and you realize that if the intentions are the same, there is no moral distinction. So the prediction would be that the French and the Quebecois would not show the action bias that I told you tonight. That's what we need to find out. Is that true? Or do the French and the Quebecois see the action bias just like everybody else, but they learn a little local rule? Just like in the case of religion and abortion. Similarly, going back to the beginning of tonight's talk, the active euthanasia and passive euthanasia distinction has been obliterated in countries like Belgium and the Netherlands. Now, if you want to engage in active euthanasia, it's perfectly permissible. A body of doctors, together with the family, decide
And if they decide that active euthanasia is permissible, so it is. Do people in Holland and Belgium not see the action-mission distinction? Same question as for France and Quebec. How has this penetrated the psychology? Has it overturned it, or just given it? And lastly, perhaps the most interesting, perhaps the most relevant for us as Americans, comes from the 9/11 attacks. About a year ago, the German government engaged in a discussion about whether it would be legally permissible for someone to shoot a plane down, knowing that the plane is in control by a militaristic, threatening terrorist group, in order to save many more people. Exactly the 9/11 case. Was the German government's decision? No, it is not. It is not legally permissible, even if you know. Why? Because if you look at the German law, it was built post the Nazi period, and it's internally logical to avoid any utilitarian argument. Anything about the greater good is blocked. The 9/11 case is an argument for the greater good. It's okay to take the lives of some if you can save the lives of many. They block that. Is it a case that German people are more deontological, more based on the means and less on the consequences? I bet not. There may be this local rule, but my guess is it will not penetrate the local psychology. So the take-home message is that we have evolved certain kinds of distinctions. Those distinctions tell a story about where we came from and where we may be going. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for coming, and thank you again, Mark.